This presentation by Professor Michael Pettis, titled How Long Can China Grow? Government Policies and Implications for the Investment Industry, was recorded at the Australia Investment Conference.
One correction to prove that I really am one of you. I was introduced as a managing director at Shenyun Wangguo, which is a Chinese investment bank. About 2 weeks ago, another Chinese investment bank, Guoshen, took away the whole team. So I'm no longer at Shenyun Wangguo, I'm at Guoshen. Very typical for the street, right? What I want to talk about in China, I think, is going to appear very, very gloomy. But what I want to stress is that my outlook for China is not especially gloomy. My assessment of the last decade for China is very gloomy. And what I expect over the next several years, perhaps stretching as long as a decade, is a significant adjustment of policies that have been incredibly distortionary to the Chinese economy and that need to be adjusted. I'm often referred to as a China bear, and that's a word I really hate. I'm not a China bear. I'm a skeptic. And in some of the incredibly feverish statements we've heard in the press and among my former investment banking brethren about the prospects in China, as well as in some of the things we hear about the imminent collapse of China, I have to say that much of that I find to be very, very questionable and frankly nonsense. There are some very, very big problems that China faces, and a lot of the long-term expectations that many of us have for China, whether it is that China will be the largest economy in the world in 5 years, I'll take that bet, it won't, or whether it'll collapse in 5 years, I'll also take that bet, it won't. I think the truth is a little bit more boring. It's somewhere in the middle. Now, the reason I'm a skeptic, I think, is because I've tried to ground my understanding of what's happening in China within an historical context. You will often hear that what's happening in China is unprecedented. We've never seen anything like this before. And that, of course, is not true. There's nothing in economics that we've never seen before. What China is a version of an old development model that has been taken to an extreme that we haven't seen before. But this is a development model that we know quite a lot about. And knowing quite a lot about this development model, I think we can make some reasonably safe predictions of what the outcome is likely to be. So how old is the model? Well, if you really want to impress academics and become very pedantic, you can argue that this model was actually developed probably sometime around the 1820s and 1830s by the French. And the French argument back then was 100 years ago we were richer than the Brits, and today we're not. We're much poorer, we don't have the industrial capacity, et cetera, et cetera. So what went wrong? And the conclusion, or one of the major conclusions, was that the British financial system did an extremely good job of identifying economically viable projects and investing in those projects. Railroads, canals, toll roads, manufacturing capacity, etc. And France, for whatever reason, the French financial system wasn't able to do so. So in the early 1840s, the French created one of the seminal financial institutions in history, the so-called Crédit Immobilier, whose point was to accumulate the savings of the middle class, who previously did not save in the financial system, and to direct those savings to very specific types of investment, which were determined by the central government as being economically useful investments. Railroads, canals, all that sort of thing. And that model has been used many times by many countries. In the 19th century, countries like Spain, Italy, Greece all created their own versions of the Crédit Immobilier and all generated tremendous growth for periods of time. The growth always stopped. In the 20th century, we've had variations on that model. A German American economist by the name of Gerschenkron sort of formalized the model in the 1920s. And his argument was basically the same argument. When you have a financial system that is not performing its function of allocating capital into economically viable, economically necessary investments, you get very, very slow growth. And so one of the things you do is develop a financial system that does exactly that. And many countries followed this model. Germany and Italy in the 1930s followed this model. We can't really use them as an exception because that ended in war, so it's hard to know how it would have turned out. But it's interesting to note that according to a professor at Oxford by the name of Tooze, I forget his first name, who wrote a really great book of about the German economy in the 1930s, he'd argued that one of the reasons for the invasion of Poland in 1939, when the generals actually wanted it in 1942 when they would have been ready, is because the economy would have collapsed by 1942 because of debt. That's interesting because I'm going to return to this issue of it would have collapsed because of debt. Because there were other examples of this type of very rapid investment-driven growth in which financial resources were accumulated in financial institutions controlled by the central government and allocated into investment decisions made by local and central government officials. In the 1950s and 1960s, the best example of this was probably the Soviet Union. It's hard to remember that now. But in the 1960s, the big worried debate Americans had was exactly when would the Soviet Union overtake the United States as the world's largest economy. The Soviet Union was growing so quickly that the debate was not about if, but rather when. And everyone knew it would be before the end of the 20th century. But the question is, how much before? The Soviet Union was growing very, very quickly. But sometime in the late 60s or early 70s, we're not sure exactly when because our data isn't very good, something happened. The growth more or less flatlined, and we know the consequences. There was very little growth in the 70s and 80s, and ultimately we had the political associations with very low growth, etc. The first country to be called an economic miracle, I believe, was Brazil. In the 1960s and 70s, beginning in the late 50s, but mostly in the 60s and 70s, it achieved growth rates of above 10% for well over a decade. It grew very, very quickly. Using, again, a similar investment-driven model, driven largely by Brazilian development banks. And it, too, grew very rapidly up to a point and then stopped growing. By 1975, growth was slowing down because it was unable to continue financing itself domestically. And I'm going to keep coming back to that. And then we had the lucky event, perhaps lucky, perhaps not, of the major petrodollar recycling in the beginning around 1975, when once again we got another spurt of growth in Brazil, very high debt levels. By 1979, 1980, growth more or less stopped. And of course, the 1980s were subsequently referred to by Brazilians as the lost decade. GDP growth actually contracted over that decade in the form of a debt crisis. There are other examples. Japan in the 1970s and 1980s grew extremely rapidly. That's recent enough that I don't think I need to discuss too much what happened, but we do know that after 1990, Japan ended up with an enormous amount of debt and basically zero growth, about 0.5% growth a year for about 20 years. So what is it about this growth model that in every previous example has generated tremendous growth, miraculous growth in the early stages, and then growth stopped? And growth stopped in the middle of a huge amount of debt. And I would argue that this problem is intrinsic to the model. The way I see it, in the very early stages of the growth model, it's relatively easy to find investment opportunities. So, for example, 20 years ago, 30 years ago in China, there was very little infrastructure. There was very little manufacturing capacity. And it was quite easy to build roads, build railroads, build manufacturing capacity that had a positive net value. But at some point, when you have the fastest growth rate in investment in history, at some point you begin exhausting all of the most obvious investment opportunities. How do you know when you're no longer able easily to identify economically viable projects? Well, the problem is you don't know. Why don't you know? Because the pricing signals are so heavily distorted that you have no way of telling whether or not a project is economically viable. And the most important pricing signal is typically the interest rate. As you may know, in the last decade especially, interest rates in China, the lending rate, if you believe the CPI numbers, which of course none of us do, but if you believe the CPI numbers, the lending rate has been close to zero or sometimes even negative for much of the past decade. If you use other proxies for inflation, PPI or the GDP deflator, it's been negative almost the entire decade. So with negative interest rates, negative lending rates, it's very hard to know that your project is not economically viable, especially when loans are never repaid. They're constantly rolled over. But then there's another problem with the model, and this is something that Rick alluded to. When your prospects for promotion depend primarily on the growth you generate over the next few years, you have this tremendous distortion in the incentive structure. And the way the distortion works is pretty straightforward. When you invest, you get the benefits of the growth in your jurisdiction, right? If I'm the mayor and I build the subway, all the benefits of building the subway I get. I get higher employment in my city. I get higher GDP growth in my city. If I'm so inclined, I can hire my brother-in-law and other friends. The benefits are all heavily concentrated. But the costs, because it's all funded through the national banking system, the costs are spread out throughout the entire country through the banking system. In addition, you have a timing distortion. The benefits of an investment accrue over the next 2, 3, 4 years. The costs of the investment accrue over the period of the loan repayment. And since loans are never repaid, basically the cost of the investment is spread out over the next 10, 20 years. So let's assume for a moment that there was a way of telling that investment is being misallocated, that we are investing in projects that destroy wealth rather than create wealth. The problem with this model is that, first of all, I don't know when we've reached that point. And secondly, the incentives for me to ignore that, even if I knew, are so high that there's a very high probability that I will ignore it. A misallocated investment in China occurs not because people are stupid, but as Rick points out, it's a systematic problem. The system requires you to keep on pumping up investment well past the stage where it's being wasteful, where it's being misallocated. So, is investment, have we reached that point in China? Well, I think by now there is very little doubt, at least among economists within Beijing, that in the last 3 years we have been misallocating investment on a massive scale. But I would argue that it's much older than that. I would argue that probably beginning in the late 1990s, we began misallocating capital. We began investing in a way that actually subtracts growth rather than adds to it. But we don't recognize that it subtracts growth until many, many years. And there are circumstantial reasons for believing that, and there are more important systemic reasons for believing that. The circumstantial reasons for believing it is that, you know, when I moved to China in 2002, one of the first things that impressed me, and it impresses, I think, many people who have spent a lot of time in developing countries, was the quality of Chinese infrastructure. China had probably the best infrastructure in the world in 2002. Now, that may surprise some people, but infrastructure can't be measured nominally. Infrastructure is a relative thing. So when I say that China had the best infrastructure in the world, I mean for its level of development. The purpose of infrastructure is to increase labor productivity, and so the value of infrastructure depends very heavily on the level of wages and the level of worker productivity. You will often hear people say, China hasn't overbuilt in infrastructure, look at Japan. China is a long way from catching up to Japan. If anyone tells you that, he fundamentally misunderstands the purpose of infrastructure. The purpose of infrastructure is not to match Japan. It's to increase productivity by more than the cost of that infrastructure. So in a country like China, in which wages and productivity are roughly one-tenth the level of Japan, it would make no sense for China to have a Japanese-style level of infrastructure. The optimal amount of infrastructure in China is very, very much lower than it would be in a developed country. You should really compare China with Jamaica, a country whose per capita income is roughly the same. And in that sense, 10 years ago, China already had astonishing infrastructure. But it didn't stop. It kept building more and more. In fact, it accelerated infrastructure spending. And it still can't stop. You can go to any secondary city or tertiary city in China, you'll find a brand new unused airport. And they're going to build 45 more airports in the next 3 years. My Chinese students can't even name cities that don't have airports. but somehow they're going to build 45 more. And on top of it, they're building the famous high-speed rail network, which is not appropriate for a country as poor as China. But among other things, the high-speed rail network undermines air travel. Nobody flies when they can take a fast train, or at least until the recent crash, that was the expectation. People would always take the train. So we're building infrastructure on top of infrastructure on top of infrastructure, and that feels very wasteful. But we have harder evidence that investment has been seriously misallocated for quite a long period of time. One of the pieces of evidence, is when you look at the profitability of the state-owned sector, which absorbs something like 50% of all the loans in China. There were three very interesting studies that have been done, two by a Chinese think tank and one by the think tank associated with the Hong Kong Monetary Authority. And I'll refer to them because the numbers to me are striking. One study, which came out this year by a Chinese think tank by the name of Unirule, suggested that 70% of the profitability of the SOE sector is accounted for by monopoly pricing. Now, monopoly pricing, as you know, is simply a tax. It's a tax on the household sector, and it's used to subsidize the monopolist. So that argument suggests that the actual profitability, if you remove this implicit tax, this huge gift from households to the SOEs, is only 30% of the nominal profitability of the SOE sector. But it doesn't stop there. The same think tank also this year came out with another study in which they looked back over the last decade and they counted all the direct subsidies given by the state to the SOE sectors, oil price subsidies, real estate subsidies, cash subsidies, etc. And what they found is that total subsidies accounted for slightly more than 100% of the aggregate profitability of the SOE sector. So now we've got 100% plus 70% of the profitability of the SOE sector is accounted for by monopoly pricing or by direct subsidies. This is all gifts from the household sector. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority study, or the think tank associated with them, was to me even more shocking. What they asked is, do SOEs benefit from the implicit guarantee in their borrowing costs? They checked the borrowing costs for SOEs against other large Chinese manufacturers, adjusted for size and leverage. And what they found, not surprisingly, I think, is that SOEs do have a borrowing advantage, roughly 90 to 100 basis points because of the implicit guarantee. They then asked how much of the profitability of the SOE sector is explained by that 90 to 100 bips. And what they found there was that roughly 100% of the aggregate profitability of the SOE sector is explained by 90 to 100 basis points. Now, this to me is astonishing because interest rates in China, depending on which model you use, are anywhere from 400 to 800 basis points too low. And very low interest rates, remember, is simply a transfer from depositors to borrowers. So when you add up all of these various subsidies, all of these various gifts from the household sector to the SOE sector, you come up with a number that may be 600, 700, 800, I don't know, but a huge percentage of total profitability. In other words, SOEs are actually losing an amount of money every year equal to anywhere from 6 to 8 times their stated profitability. But they're not showing those losses because of massive subsidies from the household sector. So that to me is pretty strong evidence that investment in the SOE sector is being misallocated. But there's other reasons to believe that this is the case. The first reason is that if it really were true that assets are being wasted, that investment is being wasted, if there is massive misallocation, then you would also expect that whichever sector of the economy is effectively paying for that misallocation, their share of economic wealth should be declining. Is there such a sector in China? Yes, of course there is. It's called the household sector. Household wealth in China, household income in China, is roughly 50%. I think it's the lowest ever recorded in history. And it's declined very rapidly in the last decade. A better measure of household wealth for me is always household consumption, because households sort of figure out what their real wealth is and consume based on that. And at the beginning of the decade, Chinese consumption was 46% of GDP. That's not an unprecedented number, but that's a very low number. The low-consuming Asian countries typically consume between 50 to 55% of GDP. The world typically consumes 60 to 65% of GDP. We have seen numbers at 45, 46% before. Malaysia, after the Asian crisis for about a year, consumption dropped to 45%. But it's pretty rare. It's a crisis number. That's where China began the century. By 2005, consumption had dropped to an unprecedented 40% of GDP. Why is that bad? It's bad because the three sources of demand are domestic consumption, domestic investment, and then the net external sector, the trade surplus. And with such a low consumption share of GDP, that meant China was overly reliant on increases in domestic investment and on increases in the trade surplus to generate growth. So in 2005, when these very low numbers came out, it created a bit of a shockwave in Beijing, and a consensus very rapidly developed that we must increase the consumption share of GDP. So a lot of people said, great, once Beijing recognizes a problem, it solves it. So we don't have to worry about consumption anymore. But the skeptics among us said, no, it's impossible. They cannot solve it. Consumption will continue declining. And the reason is because the growth model itself, because it's misallocating investment on a massive scale, and because that misallocation must be paid for out of transfers from the household sector, consumption will not grow as a share of GDP. It'll stagnate at 40%. That's pretty much what I and a few other friends predicted. Well, we were wrong. It didn't stagnate at 40%. The last numbers that we have, the last formal numbers, were 2009. It had dropped to 35%, a surreal number. Last year, it's pretty certain it dropped to 34%. And I expect that this year it's going to be in the 33 to 34% region. In other words, no matter what they do, they cannot raise the consumption share of GDP. And I would argue that this is a necessary condition if this growth model, if my interpretation of the growth model is correct. So clearly that doesn't prove I'm right, but it does suggest that there is a very good chance that this interpretation of the growth model is correct, because it is very hard to explain a completely unprecedented collapse in the consumption share of GDP from already a very low level. What other evidence is there that we may be misallocating investment on a massive scale? Well, if you are misallocating investment and the investment is credit driven, in other words, if you borrow money to invest and the value of your investment is less than the cost of your investment, then by definition you should see an unsustainable rise in debt. And remember, when we look at Japan, when we look at Brazil, when we look at the Soviet Union, Germany, etc., the Asian miracle countries, we all saw that. Rapid growth and at some point an unsustainable rise in debt. So around 2005, 2006, those of us who were skeptic were saying debt levels are going to become a very big problem. Debt is rising at an unsustainable pace. At the time, there was a lot of surprise. You heard statements like China has the strongest balance sheets in the world. You still hear those statements, but now I think it's astonishing that people say that. And you hear things about how debt levels are very low, et cetera, et cetera. In 2005, 2006, the counter argument was, first of all, much of the debt is hidden. It's in the form of contingent liabilities. There's a lot more debt out there than you think. And secondly, the point is not that debt is currently unsustainable. The point is that it is rising at an unsustainable pace. And if there isn't a dramatic shift in the growth model, it will eventually become unsustainable. So the argument sort of floundered for a few years as to whether or not there was a debt problem in China until late 2009, when a professor at Northwestern University by the name of Victor Scher, I'm sure many of you know him, did something very, very nasty. He actually counted up all of the debt at the local and provincial government levels. I don't think anyone had done that before. He counted it up, and he came up with an astonishing number. And the first reaction was, he's completely wrong. The second reaction was, okay, he's right, but he's exaggerating. And in May 2010, Victor sent me an email with an article from the People's Daily in which they more or less agreed with his numbers. And since then, the numbers have gone up. That created a huge amount of consternation because suddenly people realized there is a lot of debt out there. And so suddenly we all became debt searchers. Even the PBOC itself started becoming very nervous about its ability actually to count the debt. In February of this year, they came up with a new concept called total social financing. And the total social financing concept was a way of measuring all the credit extended by the banking system. In the old days, we simply measured renminbi loans because they accounted for 92% of the credit as defined by the PBOC. But by 2009, what the PBOC discovered was that new renminbi loans, the proxy for credit growth in China, was only 56% of this measure called total social financing. What happened is because the regulators tried to constrain credit growth by focusing on new renminbi loans, not surprisingly, much of the credit expansion occurred outside the regulated areas in the form of bankers' acceptances, in the form of collateralized loans and trusted loans, all of these other products that were not being counted. So they came up with this new measure, total social financing, and what they found, of course, is that loan growth was much, much bigger than any of us expected. More recently, Fitch, the rating agency, has come up with a new measure, which they call adjusted total social financing, and what they found is something that many of us predicted back in February or March. Now that the PBOC is focusing on these things, which they call total social financing, the real growth is going to occur outside of it. And sure enough, Fitch's adjusted total social financing loan growth exceeded the PBOC's total social financing loan growth, which exceeded the renminbi loan growth. In other words, we are seeing very, very rapid expansion in debt. Extremely rapid expansion in debt, and any attempt to slow it down is undermined by the efforts of local government officials and the banks themselves, who are growing rapidly. Because without credit growth, make no mistake, without credit growth, there's no investment growth. And in China, without investment growth, there is no GDP growth. So where does that leave us? There is a rising recognition among the think tank, the policy advisors, the academic economists, and even some of the leaders within China that this growth model is no longer functioning, that it's too reliant on investment, and investment is being misallocated on a huge scale. And misallocated investment creates the illusion of growth today, but as the debt is repaid, that growth is subtracted from future years. And so the question is, what do we do about it? Well, the good answer is we've got to raise consumption as rapidly as we can. Because for China to rebalance away from investment in the trade surplus, by definition, means that consumption must grow faster than GDP. So if we can get consumption to grow very, very quickly, we can then maintain high GDP growth. So that's all it is. Let's get consumption to grow very quickly. In the five-year plan in March, that was the number two target. Consumption will rise as a share of GDP over the next 5 years. Well, I think it will. I think it has no choice. But there's two ways consumption growth can outpace GDP growth, right? One way is you get consumption growth to surge and GDP growth stays high. But the other way, of course, is that consumption growth doesn't surge and GDP growth drops. In both cases, you get rebalancing. By the way, that's what happened in Japan after 1990. GDP growth collapsed, but consumption growth didn't, and Japan rebalanced. So can we get consumption growth to surge in China? And my answer is no, we cannot. And the reason we cannot is because repressed consumption was fundamental to the growth model. It is the repression of consumption that allowed China to grow so quickly. How so? Because of transfers from the household sector to subsidize very rapid growth. How do these transfers work? There were three main sources of the transfer. Two of them are widely understood. One of them is only in the last year or two becoming more understood. of the most easy to understand is an undervalued exchange rate. Undervalued exchange rates generate rapid growth by repressing household consumption, right? If your exchange rate is undervalued, that acts effectively as an import tax. So it reduces the real value of household income. It puts downward pressure on household income. But of course, it's a subsidy for the tradable goods sector. So the tradable goods sector grows quickly. Notice what it does. It pushes up GDP growth, and it pushes down household income growth. The second important transfer mechanism is the relationship between wages and productivity growth. In an equilibrium, wages should grow at the same level as productivity. In China, wages in the 1980s and 1990s grew a little bit more slowly than productivity. That's pretty normal for a developing country. But for some reason, in the past decade, wage growth collapsed relative to productivity growth. Why is that important? Because it means that workers are getting a smaller and smaller share of what they produce, and employers are getting a bigger and bigger share. So notice what that does. It pushes down household income even as it pushes up production. So it has the same effect as an undervalued currency. The third transfer mechanism is, in my opinion, by far the most important, and that is what's called financial repression. As I said earlier, interest rates in China are extremely low. They're set that way by the PBOC. And most Chinese savers don't have alternative investments. So they have to put their money in the bank and get a very low interest rate. It has always been negative. Why is that important? Because a very low interest rate simply transfers money from savers, the household sector, to borrowers, who are SOEs, infrastructure investors, real estate developers, local and provincial governments, and the PBOC. This huge transfer is an enormous boost for growth. If you lower interest rates, if you make interest rates negative, then clearly people are going to invest. People are going to borrow and invest. But that doesn't come free. That comes at the expense of the household sector. So my estimate is that every year, China transferred between 5 and 7% of GDP from the households to the borrowers just in the form of repressed interest rates. That's a huge transfer. So under those conditions, it is not surprising that we got very rapid growth. It is perhaps not surprising that investment became significantly misallocated. And above all, it is not surprising that consumption declined dramatically as a share of GDP. So if you want consumption to surge, you're going to have to reverse these transfers. That's easy to say, but very hard to do. If you let the value of the currency go up, in principle, you want to do it at a slow, measured pace. Why? You want, as the value of the renminbi goes up, China loses international competitiveness, so it loses a foreign client, but it increases the value of domestic consumption, so it gains a Chinese client. So ideally, you raise it at a rate in which the foreign clients you lose are matched by the Chinese clients you gain, and there's no net loss. If you do it too quickly, though, you lose even more foreign clients, which creates financial distress on the exporter, and he may have to fire workers. And as he fires workers, domestic income goes down. So if you do it too quickly, you lose foreign clients and Chinese clients. You still rebalance, but you rebalance at negative GDP growth. So it has to be done slowly. Same thing is true with wages. The same thing is true with interest rates. If you raise interest rates by any amount, and you know interest rates have been going down in the last year. Nominally, they've been going up, but much less than inflation. So we've actually been going in the wrong direction in the last year. But if you were able to raise real interest rates, you would probably create tremendous financial distress among SOEs. And, of course, you would create even more bankruptcies among the local government funding vehicles. So you have to do all of this very slowly. Can you do it slowly? Well, it's not so easy, because while you're doing it, you've continued with these great imbalances. You've continued with misallocated investment, and you've continued with your reliance on an external surplus. As many of you may have known, or may know, the surplus was reported yesterday at, I think, $31 billion, a huge number. China still needs a large current account surplus to absorb the impact of its very low domestic consumption. So you need to change quickly in order to reduce misallocated investment, but if you change quickly, you get a significant slowdown in growth. And that's the problem China faces. The longer it postpones the adjustment, the more misallocated investment there is. And remember, the consequence of misallocated investment is continued increases in the debt. And the debt itself acts as a barrier to adjustment. Why? Because if there is a lot of debt, a lot of this unserviceable debt, and the only way you can serve it is by continued transfers, directly or indirectly, from the household sector, then the more debt you have, the more important those transfers from the household sector are in order to keep the financial system viable. And the more important those transfers, the harder it is for household income to rise quickly enough to cause a surge in consumption. So they're sort of caught in a trap, and there's no really easy way out. They need to bring investment levels down by raising interest rates. If they do, growth drops very significantly, because the only thing that creates growth in China is increases in investment. If they don't want growth to drop very, very sharply, then they've got to keep investment levels high. But as they do so, it becomes harder and harder to bring them down, because there's more and more debt out there acting as a constraint on consumption growth. So do they have an easy way out? Not really. There's really only one thing they can do to speed up the process, but politically it's very difficult. My guess is in 3 years we'll all be talking about it. Today most people think it's a silly idea, but I see no way around it. And that is, if you want household income to increase, the correct way to do it is too slow. Raise interest rates, raise wages, raise the currency. But you can transfer wealth from the state sector to the household sector in the form of privatizations or a number of ways of doing it. It means corporate governance reform, it means giving up control of the credit system, and a number of other things. But that is the one way to increase wealth very quickly in a way that increases consumption, which is why I think ultimately China will probably seriously consider massive privatizations. Now, so maybe you agree with me, maybe you don't. One of the questions I always get is anyone in China aware of what you're saying? Because there is this perception that the only China skeptics are foreigners. Let me tell you, that is completely wrong. The debate within China is much more interesting and much more ferocious than the debate outside of China about problems with the growth model. There's a very famous Chinese economist and advisor to the central bank. 2 years ago, I gave a speech a little bit similar to this at Tsinghua University, and he was the next speaker after me. And as soon as he came on, he said, "The problem with Professor Pettis is that he's a typical American. He is too optimistic." Right? So there are people who actually think the problem is even worse than what I say it is. There is a real debate going on in Beijing circles. The thing is, the debate is not allowed to be too visible. I've been told that several times. But it is taking place. And there is a perception, I don't have any great insights into the thinking of the leadership, but there is a perception that a number of senior leaders understand this. For example, I don't need to tell you, every time Premier Wen gives a speech about the economy, he sounds frightened. He talks about unbalances. And he's right. The rumors are that Li Keqiang is also very concerned about the imbalances. So there's a great hope among many of us that when the new leadership comes in the end of 2012, they will begin to take steps to rebalance. There is even growing sense among economists in Beijing that growth rates are going to slow significantly. So we're now starting to hear people talk about 5%, 6%, 7% growth rates. The problem, I think, is that now they're being very American. They're overly optimistic. For China to rebalance, I think growth rates in the next decade are going to average around 3%. That's not necessarily bad, because what really matters is what happens to household income. If Chinese growth rates slow significantly, but China genuinely rebalances, we could see income continue to grow at 5 or 6% a year, which I think is much better for China than 10 or 11% GDP growth rates with continued misallocated investment and continued growing imbalances. It's also, by the way, much better for the world. Because as China rebalances, instead of being a huge negative draw on world growth, a huge absorber of that most precious commodity, demand, its amount of negative net demand will contract as its current account surplus comes down, and that will actually be positive for the world. So it's good for China, it's good for the world. Here's where I become very gloomy, because I'm in Australia. And that is that if China rebalances, by definition, rebalancing must mean a significant contraction in investment. And if there is a significant contraction in investment, Chinese non-food commodities, non-food commodity imports, are going to drop dramatically. And my expectation is that once China begins the adjustment process, I hope in 2013, 2014, because the longer they put it off, the more likely we are to run into a debt problem. But once they begin the adjustment, I expect global demand for non-food commodities to drop significantly. And unfortunately, I think that affects certain economies like Brazil, Australia, and a number of others. So with that, I see my time is over. I will end my presentation, and perhaps we can discuss some of the other issues in the panel. Thank you very much.
Copyright 2011, CFA Institute. No part may be reproduced, stored in a retrieval system, or transmitted in any form or by any means, electronic, mechanical, recording, or otherwise, without the express prior written permission of CFA Institute. This program is designed to give accurate and authoritative information in regard to the subject matter covered. It is distributed with the understanding that CFA Institute is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, investment, or other expert advice. If legal advice or other expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional should be sought.